This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'll be reading again segments from Carl Safina's book, Eye of the Albatross, Visions of Hope and Survival, published in 2002. We're on the Masonic. The captain is Mark Lunston, who is completely convinced that there's no need for long-line commercial fishing vessels to catch and drown birds, albatrosses, as part of their operation, and all the other birds that flock around this vast food supply that the boats provide. We'll learn more about how he's accomplishing this up in the Alaskan coastal waters. We're off the coast of Kodiak Island, and they're going after sablefish, very deep, deep fish. From the mast arm over the bait station, Mark and Tim deploy the bird lines, two long streamers with vertical lines coming down to the water. The vertical rubber lines dangling from the streamers form a kind of snaking bead curtain of obstruction to flying birds. The streamers stretch about 50 yards astern. At that distance, the baited long line is already too deep for the birds to reach. That's the whole point. Two big boys on lines tied to the moving boat are also sent astern. They create commotion. The scare lines snake and slither as though the ocean imparts its own swimming motions to things. The boys continually splash and startle. The birds clearly dislike all this folderol. The splashing seems to frighten them, and they appear to fear colliding with the streamer lines. Birds continue following, sometimes landing on the roiled water of the wake, looking longingly at the sinking baited hooks. Few foamers are coming inside the streamers. Those that do don't stay very long and virtually never attempt to grab at any of the bait. The albatrosses continue following the boat, but at a safe distance, staying well clear of the gear. In fact, this year, the Masonic will achieve zero bird mortality. For the duration of the season, neither a fulmer nor an albatross and nary a gull will be drowned on a Masonic set hook. Mark's system is not unique, but what's unusual is his desire to make it work for the whole fleet. And as the saying goes, attitude makes the difference. Similar systems are mandated elsewhere, such as in New Zealand waters. But as one official of New Zealand's Department of Conservation says of the country's regulations that make streamer lines mandatory, on most boats the rules are not followed at all. Regulations alone are a waste of paper. You need education, enforcement, and willing fishermen. The fishermen in Mark's fleet are motivated partly by a fear of being shut down by short-tailed albatross kills, partly by the negative publicity they've received, and partly by a genuine desire to fish cleanly and avoid killing birds. The main thing is, they are motivated. Tim explains that 5 years ago, the fleet did not religiously use bird avoidance gear. Mark says, the regulations did it, and that required heat. Like anything else, Tim comments. Mark, who'd gotten major heartburn from environmental groups, says graciously, and we need watchdog groups, certainly. Tim adds, because extinctionists for a long time. So effective is the Masonic simple system that there's no real reason why albatrosses should be threatened by longline fishing. Few problems of such seriousness have so easy a solution, so readily available. It seems, therefore, all the more heartbreaking and ultimately unacceptable that in much of the rest of the world, longliners don't bother while birds drown and albatross populations decline. Mark has proved that where people put a little effort into it, saving albatrosses from death by hook drowning is possible. It works. Mark explains, it is pretty simple. But it's not just the streamers, it's also how the line is weighted. If you put one big weight on the end of the line, it pulls the rest of the gear so taut as you're moving forward that it's strung out along the surface like a buffet lunch before it gets far enough back to begin sinking. But if you put a lot of smaller weights on, It sinks rapidly as it's coming off the boat. The challenge is how to do that and have workable gear at the same time. We've now got quarter-pound weights every 60 feet, and it seems to be working for us. Mark says that the scare lines used to deter the birds would work less well for sword fishing because those long lines are set shallow, 60 feet from the surface, instead of on the bottom hundreds or thousands of feet down. With little weight to get them down quickly, it's less a problem for tuna long lining because they usually set deeper. But there's a glitch even here in Alaska. Though paired streamers and line weights, just like Mark uses, reduce seabird mortality by over 90%, only one out of five captains uses them. Alaska's regulations require fishers to use one of the following measures to avoid birds: bird-scaring streamers, a buoy or piece of wood towed on a rope, underwater setting requiring an expensive and sophisticated machine system, or setting only at night. The easiest thing is to throw a buoy over on a rope, and you're in compliance. So that's what the other 80% of skippers simply do. Result, Mark's kill rate has dropped to zero, but the overall rate and number of birds killed hasn't dipped. It's actually increased slightly since the regulations took effect. In Australian waters, where boats have been required to use streamer lines since the mid-1990s, albatross kills have taken a 99% drop. Why are people in Alaska allowed to do what doesn't work and not required to do what does work, when what works is so simple? And there are champions for success inside the fleet. Good question. The answer is that the National Marine Fisheries Service hasn't heard from enough people like you and me, and they're not paying enough attention to people like Mark. Happily, that situation will change because of increasing concern from both the public and industry. Mark's method will eventually become law throughout Alaska and will also spread to Canada's British Columbia. By the time we've set the third string, the first line has been deadly in the deep dark for about 5 hours. We go to pick it up, homing in on the radar reflector and bright orange buoy. Tim places the line into a power hauler amidships, and for many minutes its wheel turns and turns, dumping the line on deck for the crew to begin coiling and coiling and coiling. At great length, the first hooks begin appearing empty. The boat proceeds forward very slowly, with the line coming over the side of the boat as we crawl along its length like a spider running up its own web, summoning our line from the bottom. The boat is a bird magnet. Increasing numbers of winged scavengers are continually arriving. We've already collected a couple of hundred northern fulmars and a couple of glaucous gulls and glaucous winged gulls. They press close to the hull, waiting eagerly. Beyond them, as though proud and aloof, are perhaps 50 lazen and 4 black-footed albatrosses. Mark says if you go east, you see more black-footeds, until by the time you reach British Columbia, there are hardly any lazens. I stand shivering, trying to duck the fine bow spray, newly impressed by how comfortable the birds look on this cold sea. Their dense feathers deliver the finest kind of insulation. Their webbed feet paddling the frigid water would cost them a lot of heat, but a counter-current heat-exchanging capillary system takes the warmth from the blood leaving the body on its way to the feet and uses it to warm blood coming back into the body from those chilly toes. Cold feet, warm heart. Many of the fulmars are actually sleeping cozily, head tucked under wing. The boat is their chow wagon for a few days, and many of these birds will likely remain with us. The albatrosses, so far from the Hawaiian helter-skelter, look equally at home. Some are on the water, but many albatrosses are just sweeping around and around the boat as though for the fun of it. It doesn't seem to make much difference to them whether they're sitting or sleeping or in the air, since they expend so little energy while flying. When they do decide to land, they come in with their big feet splayed, stretching the webbing between their toes and skiing onto the heaving surface before settling their great bodies. Bobbing on the swells, two of the Lazens are actually engaged in courtship, with bills clacking, heads shaking side to side, and bowing. Don't they ever get enough? I wonder if they have traveled together. Their enthusiasm for each other spreads to two adjacent pairs. On land and at sea, albatrosses, let it be recorded, just love to dance. And Safina describes the fish that come up on the line as it's being drawn up. And there is quite a bit of other species that will be tossed overboard by catch. We're catching other things besides sable fish. About 10% comprise a variety of other fishes, stingless rays called skates, flatfish called turbot, an occasional cutlass-shaped grenadier, and several species of a group called rockfishes that are long-lived, late-maturing, and rather sensitive to fishing pressure. Of these, we see mainly short raker rockfish and idiot fish. I wonder who the last is named after. These rockfishes are an astonishing day-glow orange, the color of the crew's foul weather gear. They have enormous eyes for navigating their dark world. Many deep-sea fish are orange or red, even though this color is the first to drop out as you go deeper. By the time you're down 50 feet, anything orange or red already looks gray. As the light dims with depth, red looks black. Many deep-living fish are pigmented bright red or orange, so they will be gray to black where they live, depending on how much light is penetrating, a passive, self-adjusting form of camouflage. We discard the skates, turbots, and grenadiers. We keep the rockfishes, the sablefish, of course, and the occasional halibut. Every fishery captures and kills marine life it is not trying to catch, and this bykill accounts for fully a quarter of the entire world catch, roughly 27 million tons of sea life annually killed and discarded. Some kinds of fishing gear have enormous bykill. In certain parts of the world, shrimp nets kill more than 8 pounds of juvenile fish and other marine creatures for every pound of shrimp. Alaska's sablefish and halibut fleet has relatively less bykill than many other fisheries. Masonic's lines are set on the slope so as to lay across a range of depths. Halibut are more common on the shallower end of the miles-long string. These are not large ones as halibut grow, but they are large anyway, up to 50 pounds, the size of a desktop. They live a life of ambush, lying flattened on the bottom, scanning their scant heaven for scarfable prey. They hatch as free-swimming larvae, and as they settle in for a life sentence of lying on one side, like all flounders and soles, one eye migrates until both are on the same side of their head. This doesn't look as strange as it is, because nature bundles grace into all things functional. These are large eyes to help them gather intelligence in the dark, cold water. With those eyes and their rounded lips, a halibut looks oddly friendly. Flecked with white caps beneath gray skies, the ocean emanates a cold, uninviting countenance. Yet it proves home to many creatures. Visible through binoculars, across the whole sweep of distant view, are moving seabirds silhouetted against the pewter sea and low clouds. A mile away, a large flock of albatrosses has gathered over some feast unseen to us. We can see about 100 of them wheeling and circling and landing in the water. I wonder what they're eating. Possibly salmon are attacking herring under those albatrosses. I like seeing them foraging naturally, not mobbed and beggared behind the boat. Sean at the rail, gaffing, swinging, suddenly spots a short-tailed albatross. It's considerably larger than the Hawaiian albatrosses. Sean emphasizes to me something I know very well, how fortunate I am to see one. Someone says, I hate seeing the short tails because it scares me to think of what they could do to us. It's good to know that they're out there. We just have to make sure nothing ever happens to one. Sean, talking to me while watching the hooks coming up, gaffing, swinging, says, One day last year, we had 4 short-tailed albatrosses around the boat. You'd better believe we were towing all kinds of stuff to make sure the short-tails would get nowhere near the gear. I asked Mark how he became the spiritual leader and guru of the fleet's efforts to avoid killing seabirds. He laughs and then pauses before saying, "We had never caught very many birds, but a couple of years ago there were so many birds in one area that we were killing several laysan albatrosses a day. We'd never done that. We'd kill a fulmar once in a while, but it was really distressing to be killing albatrosses. I felt it was kind of a crime. The laysan is my favorite. They're just such strikingly beautiful flyers. All the albatrosses are. I don't know, it just seemed like it was bad juju to be doing that, bad karma. On the first halibut schooner I worked on, the Grant, we'd towed buoys if we had a lot of birds around. We weren't using them for conserving seabirds, we just didn't want hooks going down without bait, obviously. So while we were in this spot with so many birds, we spent a few days trying different things to keep them away. We were towing different stuff around. After several days, we found a combination that worked really well. Since then, we've tried different things, but variations on the Japanese bird line, basically streamers coming off a line, towed from the roof of the baiting station, seem to work best. Our bird avoidance experiments seem to coincide with environmentalist concerns about the endangered shorttails being at risk from longlining. Our fleet had a couple of short-tailed albatross kills, so we had to do something here. Plus the problems faced by other albatrosses in other fisheries. So we figured out a solution that was working for us, and I published an article in the Alaska Fisherman's Journal. Tim suddenly announces, "We got about 2,500 pounds from the first string, plus 500 pounds of halibut." He interprets to me, "Not bad, not great. We do it all over again, and again. Each time we pick up a few miles of fishing gear, we rebait thousands of hooks and send the line down and pick up the next miles-long string. Sometimes hook after hook brings a fish. Sometimes a long series of hooks comes up empty. The men comment repeatedly that the catching is spotty, that the area must have been worked recently by another boat. In this big ocean where we will see no sign of other humans for days, it seems astonishing that one other boat could have a noticeable effect, but the fish occur in concentrations. They're not just spread everywhere. That's why we ran 36 hours to get here, because in the vast sea there aren't as many fish in as many places as you might first guess." Late afternoon, hauling, Sean Bailey is taking another shift at the rollers, gaffing, swinging. When one rather large fish comes up, it falls off the line before Sean gets the gaff hook in. A thing measurable in dollars splashes back. Sean reaches with the long gaff handle. Cal shouts enthusiasm, "Get it, Bailey!" Sean reaches his utmost as the fish slowly begins to sink. As he stretches farther over the rail, his feet come off the deck just as a swell rocks the boat, and in the next instant he's over the rail and in the bone-chilling Alaskan ocean wearing boots and heavy clothing. The fulmars hesitate. Cal leaps over the fish checker and reaches over the rail screaming, "Bailey, grab my hand!" His face showing full knowledge that unless the next move is perfect, he is dead. Sean grasps Cal's hand, but the boat is still sliding slowly forward, and with all his clothing sodden, Sean is so heavy that their grip breaks. Sean is drifting toward the stern, and in a moment he will be alongside the covered bait deck, and there will be no way to reach over to grab him before the boat slips past him, and by then his clothes could sink him. Mark is already bent over the last inch of rail, extending a life ring. Sean locks his elbow around the ring. Mark and Cal struggle together, trying to haul him aboard. Bailey hits the deck, uttering a guttural groan that comes from fright and shortness of breath combined. Already cold, stunned, he's having trouble breathing. When he and the rest of us regain our composure, Sean goes to warm up and find dry clothes. Warming takes a while. On deck, the crew is quieter than usual. Mark comments that no one has fallen overboard in 12 years. When Sean reappears, apparently okay, and smiling sheepishly, the jokes start. That is dedication to fishing, man, when you're willing to go in after them. And it was a big one, too. Come on, Bailey, it's still your roller turn. Quit slacking. Hey, Bailey, the trip's not over yet. You can't leave us. Bailey moves back to his place, and Cal goes back to cleaning. Cal says, your eyes were about this big. Last time I saw a face like that, it had a hook in it. Sean resumes working. Gaff, swing. He says, I knew those clothes could sink me. I knew that in a minute or two my hands would get useless. A fish falls off, and Sean begins to lean over for it, and then turns around, flashing a big grin. Max says, go, Bailey, get him! Still grinning, Sean waits for the next hook. The working continues, hook after hook, until the whole string is done. Then the big buoys and the flag with flasher atop come aboard, then the lengthy line and anchor. Recounting of Sean's near-death experience on the wrong side of the element interface continues throughout the long day. By sundown, Mark has already received an email reply from Sean's stepfather admonishing Sean that when a man named Spence fell off the Republic, he at least got the fish he was after. That chide, notwithstanding, these guys, at least Masonic's crew, are not the macho types I was expecting. For such laborious and hazardous fishing, they are inured to hard work without being hardened by it, and they do less swaggering than some sport fishermen I know. Perhaps that is because just being part of the crew proves plenty. Nobody has to fake anything. The work is difficult and dangerous enough to weed out the strutters. Mark's comment, there's no room for prima donnas. This requires teamwork. I will end there, and we will get back aboard the Masonic next week. I'm reading segments from Carl Safina's book, Eye of the Albatross, Visions of Hope and Survival, published in 2002. This is Maggie Jones in Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.